Accession number 8736, room number 33.
Lord Harding, tape 33. Of course, the Korean War would have broke out while you were in Malaya, Lord Harding. Could I ask you now about this?
yes, I can't remember precisely when it broke out, but soon after it did break out, I was told to provide a British detachment, as I call it, up there. And I said that I thought it ought to be a full brigade coup. And I was prepared to find that, although I was very short of things like, I had very little armor and very little artillery, but I was prepared to find a full brigade group. However, the powers that be in London decided that it should be a brigade of two battalions with an anti-tank battery, and that the Americans would provide artillery support and logistics support. And so we selected a brigade headquarters in Hong Kong and the Middlesex Regiment in the Argyll and Southern Highlanders and prepared them to go up and with an anti-tank battery and signals, a brigade signal section. And that was what eventually went up there. And they gave a very good account of themselves. It wasn't, the Americans were in some difficulties at that time. They were in being driven back, and it wasn't an easy or cozy situation. But they did enter into the battle, and they did very well. I think I remember the Argylls had heavy casualties, and so did the Middlesex Regiment. But they did well. My most vivid recollection about the whole thing is being told that when they went to Korea, the troops would lose their colonial alliance, which they were entitled to when they were serving in Hong Kong. I can't remember the precise sum, but it was quite a useful daily allowance. Maybe a few shillings a day, that sort of thing, but it all added up. And so I said, I complained and protested about this decision and said that it ought to be done at ministerial level, at home. And the troops informed that way. So, but in the, after exchange of signals, I was told that I blinking well had to do it myself. And I remember going up to Hong Kong, and I think it was the, whether it was my Middlesex or the Argyll, and talking to one of the troops of one regiment and saying, telling them this sad event that they would lose their colonial lands, but we had been successful in making certain that they would continue to do it for the first 3 months that they were away. And much to my delight and surprise, I was applauded by one of the two battalions that I addressed on this subject. But they were taken from the Hong Kong garrison. At that time, the threat of a Chinese attack on Hong Kong had, I thought, substantially diminished. And so I was quite happy about letting them go, but I still think it would have been better if we'd been able to assemble a full brigade group. What the people at home, the people in London, said, no, you send a small brigade of two battalions, headquarters, anti-tank signals, and while we are preparing a full-strength brigade group at home to follow on. And that was what was done. It was a diversion, but I'm glad that I flattered myself that I put the case for the losing the colonial allowance not too badly, because they did give me a round of applause when I'd finished talking to them about it.
When the war broke out, you know, when the North Koreans invaded the South, how was this perceived? You know, how did you yourself perceive it? Did you think it was a Korean affair, or did you think there was more to it, that perhaps the Russians, maybe the Chinese, were involved as well?
Oh, I thought it was if the North Koreans had succeeded in defeating the South Koreans and had acquired control over the whole of Korea, I thought it was a serious threat to the Allied. But by Allied, I mean ourselves, the Americans, and by that time the Japanese, position in the Far East, and particularly in the northern part of the Far East. And so that's why I was only too keen to send as strong a force as I could afford, and one that would be effective in stopping or helping the Americans to hold the position there. Yeah, I thought it was an operation which the North Atlantic powers, in support of Japan and of our position in the Far East, had to make certain that didn't go wrong. And then, of course, when the Chinese intervened, it made it all the more important.
Do you think the fact that having British troops in a situation like that brings influence as well on the other troops, you know, such as the Americans in the area? Does it mean that you can have more say politically?
Well, I think so. I think so, yes. I think, yes, I would have thought so. I think you've got comparable situations, like in Lebanon, for example. Yes, I think so. But I think... I got old ideas about the Lebanon, but I think the important thing is to make sure that it is an Allied force and not just a lot of independent national contingents. Like, well, that is what happened in the Lebanon, which I think was a seeds of disaster, or not disaster perhaps, but defeat. I would have been very strongly opposed to having a separate British command system. I think the whole thing had to be under one command, and that, for obvious reasons, had to be an American command. And I think the same applies to the other two services. There weren't much Air Force involved, but the Navy were heavily involved. And I think the whole thing had to be under the command of the senior partner, which was, in that case, in Korea, was the Americans.
How much Russian involvement did you think there was at the time when it first broke out, the war?
I don't know that I formed any opinion. I don't remember, but I mean, by that time, you see... As far as I was concerned, and I think this applies to the British outlook in the Far East generally, we regarded the Chinese communist government as I said, an expanding power in the Far East, and one that would, if it went the full course of their ambitions, would be very damaging to the British interests in the Far East.
So does that
including
mean
Hong Kong and Southeast Asia?
So would you have seen more Chinese influence in Korea than Russian then?
I would have said I don't know at all. I know nothing on which to base an opinion on that. But I would have thought it was entirely a Chinese. After all, by that time, Chinese and the Russians had fallen out, hadn't they? I can't remember when it was, but there was a chap called Borodin, wasn't it, who went to China and tried to, impose Russian influence on the Chinese, and was really seen off. But that was before the Korean War.
Oh, yes, that was quite early, wasn't it, Borodin? Yes, unless I know he went very early on in the 20s. And possibly maintained contact since then.
I don't know whether I thought so at the time, but I certainly think now, and I think I probably thought so at the time, that it was entirely a Chinese venture.
Did you have any fears that the Korean War was going to escalate into something very much bigger. Did you fear this at any time?
Well, I think one always gets worried. Yes, I think one always has fears about that. Once a conflict starts in any part of a large theater, and I look upon, I mean, actually there are, as far as we're concerned, China, the Far East is a theater, is a strategic theater. And if you have a conflict starting in any one part of the theater, it's very liable to spread. And if it had spread down into Southeast Asia, well, then we would have been heavily involved.
Were you at all worried about General MacArthur and his drive north, you know, crossing the Yalu, and various other statements he made? I wonder how you reacted to that.
I don't remember reacting at all, except to think that I don't know. No, I wouldn't like to answer that question. I don't know.
Did you know anything about General MacArthur?
I did not at that time, except that, of course, I knew about his operations in the Far East at the end of the war. In the latter part of the war, how successful he'd been, I looked upon him as a flamboyant commander, but a very courageous and successful one. But no, I didn't really know much about him. I got to know a good deal about him more after, when I went up to Korea to see the troops that I'd sent up there. I was the guest of the British ambassador, and he arranged for me and one of my staff to go and have lunch with MacArthur. Unfortunately, I didn't have much time for discussion with him then. I was put to sit at one end of the table with Mrs. MacArthur, and he was at the other end. I did have some talk with him. But I was able to discuss with his staff the various problems that were worrying me, like the support, logistic support of the British contingent, and various other problems that they had. And then I went off to see them, went over to Korea to see them, horrified with the nature of that country. It's a terribly rugged country, but found them all in very good heart and confident that they were able to hold their own, and discussed their problems with them. Then I went back to Japan, but while I was in Korea, MacArthur was sent for to meet Truman at Midway Island, and was that moment when he was put on the spot by Truman and said that he wasn't a little King Emperor and he'd have to conform to whatever the American administration wanted him to do, and would accept orders and so on from the White House, I suppose. When I got back to Japan, he hadn't come back there from Midway. And the British ambassador was anxious for me to stay and have further talks with him on his return. But I had plenty to deal with down in Laos, and I had settled what problems I had regarding the British contingent in Korea with his staff. And so I said, no, I'm sorry, I think I'll have to get back. So I did. So I never met him again.
Remember what the problems were that you had to deal with in Korea with the British?
There were mostly logistic problems, really, and the question of artillery support, and the differences in communication systems, particularly in calling for artillery support and air support and directing air support and military and artillery support, as between American and British systems of controls and communication.
You mentioned
those are the main difficulties, and supply, in the question of our system of supply is different from theirs. Our rations and our other arrangements, ammunition supply and so on, are different from the Americans. And these created some problems, not all that difficult, and ones that could be solved by understanding and by discussion and understanding. And that I was able to do with the MacArthur staff.
When you visited Korea for this first time, had things sort of settled down to stalemate around the 38th parallel?
No, there was the front was static, but I wouldn't say there was stalemate. No, the front was static, and it was before the MacArthur's Incheon landing. Well, just about that time, I think, whether it was before or after the Americans landed on the north of the behind the North Korean front and drove the North Koreans back. I think it was about that time, or it may have been a little before, a little after. I think it was after that time, and the movement, the front was starting to move forward again then, as far as I recollect, but my memory is a bit hazy about that.
When you heard about MacArthur's idea to go into mainland China, did that worry you at all?
Well, I thought it was nerves. It was his problem, not mine. And I thought, well, by that time, I can't remember whether the 29th Brigade, the full British Brigade group, I don't think they had joined up with the Korean forces then, American forces in Korea by then. I would have been concerned. I mean, he was a very dashing commander. Whether the British contingent would be in danger of being getting a bloody nose, but I'm not really worried.
What do you think the effects of the Korean War was upon rearmament? Did you notice any dramatic change? No, as a military man?
No, I knew that, the Korean War, I knew from reports from home that the Korean War had convinced the then British government that they had to go in for a measure of rearmament. No, I didn't know much about it. And it didn't really affect me. But at that time, I was satisfied that we'd done all we could by way of making Hong Kong defensible. Hong Kong is only defensible if you have air superiority in the region, in that region. Then it is defensible. And we had done all we could, in my opinion, to make Hong Kong defensible, provided that we were able to maintain a degree, a considerable measure of air superiority over that region. So that I'd ceased to worry about that. But I was still concerned, of course, about the emergency in Malaya. And that was what was demanding my attention.
Could I now ask you, Lord Hardinge, about your appointment as commander of the British Army on the Rhine in 1951? When did you first hear about this appointment?
Well, it must have been sometime while I was still in the Far East. I don't remember precisely when it was, but I suppose probably it may have been in the spring of 51, was it? Yes. But we came home from the Far East in that summer, in July, I think it was. And I was told that I'd have a bit of leave and then go and take over the Rhine Army. I'm not sure when I knew about it, but sometime before I left Singapore. And I was very pleased, of course, it was a very fine command, and looking forward to it. And I hadn't, it was entirely new to me because I hadn't served in Northwest Europe during the war. I was in the Middle East throughout in Gallipoli to start with, and then in the Middle East, and then in Italy, So I didn't know Germany, and I hadn't served in Germany with the Allied forces in the final campaign there.
That must have been quite a, yes, it must have been quite a challenge.
It was a change, yes.
Yes. Did you have a lot of homework to do?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember. The CIDS must have talked to me about it and explained what his views were about the future. And then, of course, I took over. Who did I take over from? Charles Kiesley, wasn't it? Had discussions and talks with him and arrived and stepped into the seat and started to go around and meet the corps commander, who was Dudley Ward, who I knew him from the Italian days. He was commanding a division, an infantry division in the Italian campaign, so I knew him well. And he was the corps commander, and I had a very high opinion of his abilities, and we got on very well together. I also knew certainly one, if not two, of the divisional commanders, Colin Callender, who had actually been at school with me in my very early days, and Errol Pryor Palmer, who was commanding the Army Division. I think those are who was it who was commanding the other infantry division? Anyway, I can't remember now, but I did know quite a few people, certainly divisional commanders, and my chief of staff, and also I knew some of the brigadiers, of course. The army wasn't. The personalities in the Army of the Rhine were fairly well known to me, but I didn't know Germany at all, and I'd never worked, fought alongside as a commander until the final stages of the Italian campaign alongside American, and certainly not alongside French troops. So it was a great deal to learn, and a great deal to think about.
Yes, because 1951, it would have been quite a critical situation then in Germany.
Well, the other thing you see was that the most important change that was taking place was that the British Army of the Rhine and the Allied troops altogether were changing. Progressing, as I suppose you would call it, from being an army of occupation to an allied army. And this did mean a good deal of thinking about. And it was actually when I was, I set up a big exercise for the Army of the Rhine for the autumn after my arrival called Counterthrust, I think it was. And it was during that exercise, when I was at my headquarters in a forest or wood, that I was told that I was to see General Speidel and General Heusinger, who were the two senior officers of the German army who were given the task of starting off or planning the reformation, or not reformation is the wrong word, the rebuilding of the German army. And that, again, was a matter of a complicated matter and a matter of the greatest importance. And then there was a whole question of the relationships with the Dutch and the Belgians. Forces. And it was, I don't remember precisely when it was, that what was called Northern Army Group was set up. And as Commander-in-Chief of the Rhine Army, I was made responsible for command of Northern Army Group, which comprised the British, Dutch and Belgian forces in the northern part of the North Atlantic Treaty front. So there was plenty to do, a lot to think about, and on those various features, really, the change from occupation to allied functioning, the cooperative, the building up the Northern Army Group as a comprehensive and unified organization with the ourselves and the Dutch and the Belgians, and the relationships with the German people, with the High Commissioner, who was then Ivan Kirkpatrick in Bonn. So it was a busy time, but very interesting.
Of course, this would have coincided with the rearmament programme, wouldn't it? Which began under the Labour government and continued under the Conservatives.
Yes.
Were you increasing the number of British divisions at that time in
no,
Germany?
No, I don't remember. I don't think we increased the number of British divisions. I can't remember now how many divisions there were. I don't think so. I don't remember it. But they were a very slow process of rearmament started to take place.
Would your task have been mainly regarding administration and strategic planning?
Strategic planning, tactical training, cooperation with the two other national armies that were under my overall command, and generally making a plan to hold any Russian offensive against the Western Front.
When you arrived, were you satisfied with the positioning of, say, the bases and headquarters, your headquarters?
No, not at all. We started plans on a new main base in the Amsterdam area, and also I wasn't happy about the location of the headquarters, Rhine Army headquarters. Well, let's call it Northern Army Group headquarters at that stage, at Bad Oeynhausen, which was very close to the frontier. And so we started plans for moving the Northern Army Group headquarters back west of the Rhine. And those plans were laid and work was started on that change and move during my time, but it wasn't completed. And my headquarters remained at Bad Oeynhausen up to the time I left, but there was a great deal of what I call battle planning, defense planning, to do with what we did. Did we hold? Did we stand on the Weser? Did we? How did we conduct? Obviously, we couldn't hold the superior Russian forces on the Weser. But what did we do? What was the general strategy? And of course, there were a great deal of discussions. I remember very well a gathering meeting that Eisenhower arranged with myself and the American commander-in-chief and the French commander-in-chief.